Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do the overlapping influences of family, ethnicity, nationality, education, and culture make us who we are? Author Binyavanga Wainaina grew up middle class in Kenya's third largest city. His Ugandan mother owned a beauty salon. His father belonged to the largest ethnic group in the country and worked in farming and business. The family hoped he would study law or medicine, but from an early age, Wainaina was hopelessly captivated by the power of language, so that by elementary school he was polishing off a novel every day, and an early 20s identity crisis of sorts found him dropping out of university in South Africa to do little more than eat, read, and sleep. Gradually, his desire to understand the world drove him to record his observations and organize his thoughts through writing. Today, Wainaina is founding director of the African literary magazine Kwani and director of the Chinua Achebe Center for African Writers and Artists at Bard College. His new memoir is called One Day I Will Write About This Place. Binyavanga, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you. From the time of your earliest memories, you recall being fascinated by words, by the sounds of them, by what they meant, by how they made you feel. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I guess before I started to read, and I don't think, maybe I was 9 or 10 when I kind of started reading novels and immediately fell in love with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't an exceptionally good student. I was fairly lazy. My sister was a good student and that sort of thing. But the way I see it, I think I was those kids who just kind of was like 10 seconds behind everybody else, maybe a little bit more, tripping over myself and following. And my sister Shiro, who's a year and a half younger than me, always seemed to know her way in the world. It always just seemed to me as if people knew their way. So I'm always decoding people's sounds and mimicking them and people's movements and mimicking them so that I wouldn't seem to be so stupid. I kind of think that's where it comes from. A certain kind of vagueness, a certain kind of confusion, and a certain kind of person who ends up being the watcher of others. Mm-hmm. In order to find their way.
It seems like the perfect way to grow up if you're going to become a writer.
Yes, but I'm not... for the purposes of a career advancement, I'm not sure that it was the appropriate way, but I'm grateful I was able to find something to do ultimately. But somebody once told me that I was reading this sentence by this young Kenyan writer just yesterday, an unpublished story. I was saying something that all he wanted to do was lie down and watch the red light behind his eyelids. You know?
So,
I felt like that.
You grew up bilingual in a polyglot nation, but the English language had a particular power for you. Why do you think that is?
For practical reasons, certainly my late father, who died about a month and a half ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Who was a really extraordinary kind of self-educated man. I only found out after he died that he hadn't finished high school, had done things by correspondence courses and the like. But he was a lover of language and of communicating language in general, but the English language in particular. From when I was a kid, he used to use this book called English Usage, something out of the 1950s, and the King's English, strange enough, and talked to me a lot about apostrophes and the semicolon and that sort of thing. That was one. There was no doubt in that sense. And, of course, Kenya being a former English colony, English was our official language, the language of education. And in the 70s, when I went to school, the libraries at the time were filled with old books by departed colonials, with people's names even. So you're always inhabiting, Enid Blyton or Richmond Compton. Strange enough, at the time, there weren't that many American books. It was very much English books out of the 1940s and 50s. And so that was just, that's like a treasure chest for me. Then what else? Yeah, I think that's it.
What a remarkable view of the world that must have been, you know, growing up in Western Africa and reading about things taking place, you know, half a world away. Did it always sort of make sense to you, these stories of places that you had never been yet?
Yes. You know, I guess, you know, like all the people who talk about post-colonialism and all that sort of thing, try to maybe say there's alienation, and I know there's a lot in Caribbean and in African writing about both the colonial and post-colonial experience, about never having seen a daffodil. And I only saw a daffodil first, I think, in Wales. But it wasn't alienating at all. I mean, the world was as it came, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was very comfortable watching Little House on the Prairie, and it just was the world as the world was. I was very comfortable in all the books. The world was as the world was. And even the question of what I liked and didn't like didn't really have cultural alienation. So the distance maybe would have been, in a cultural sense, going to the sports club and meeting people who were from another world in a way, some of them Kenyans and some of them foreigners, expatriates, who you didn't know and who were alien to you somehow, and who kind of represented something to be a little bit afraid of, but something to be curious about. But they were not in any way connected to the people in the books either. So I'm a big believer in the idea that I feel like I'm a citizen of a world of characters. And now they've kind of just opened to a whole world, and that I feel very much at home with all those various characters from different places. And that was what my childhood experience was. So I know it wasn't alienating at all.
What's very interesting about that, Binyavanga, is that it appears to have given you a very nuanced picture, such as it was, of the world beyond where you lived. Meanwhile, a lot of people in the West, and I know that you've written about this in the past, have a very limited view of what Africa is. For one thing, they don't recognize the vast number of different states there are, different countries there are within Africa, and they seem to think that it's all about poverty and desperation. And in fact, your experience as a child was quite different from that.
Yes. So I guess I could separate my answer in two ways. First, it's hard. I know it doesn't make maybe very clear sense to what maybe an American audience, in a way. But you know, we came into the 20th century with a lot of interesting baggage. There are people landing in America with no shoes and post wars and things,
mm-hmm.
and discovering a world of baseball and golf courses and something like that. So I just happened to be brought up in a world that wasn't just full of golf courses. We're not rich at all. But these sorts of infrastructures that filtered the world, it occurred to me, for example, that since the 1920s or 1930s, you know, aside from the U.S., there were very few people going to school. My grandmother went to school. My father went to school. So there was a time in the last century that everybody was going to school from 6 a.m. and people were wearing uniforms in China, Russia, for reasons, you know, that are not immediately clear, but that we know. I think that we are the generation of people who went to school,
mm-hmm.
and when it comes to the continent of Africa, the Africa I know, and even as a middle class child in Kenya, I have grandparents. We have villages. We know have relatives who are not rich. We have places where there's no food, and there are places where there's bounty. But, you know, all those people go to school. They wake up in the morning, they go to school, the bell rings, it comes out, you wear uniforms and certain. So all of us suddenly, and I think this is where my point comes in, we actually belong to this modern world and are grappling with this modern world's problems as are any other person around the world. Now, but Africa as the sort of, I don't know, weird reverse exceptionalism. Maybe it's the same as the India that I consumed as a child and as an adult, which was full of gurus and strange people jumping and inserting things into their bodies,
mm-hmm.
and or people in Taiwan doing remarkable karate backflips and destroying the empire of America or some such. I don't know, but it's perpetually surprising to me and to many professional Africans, this idea that comes to the West that is persistent and lazy, that seems to wants to simplify us under a particular number of things that mean nothing to us, and under things like pity, which I feel are just a way of continuing to exert power by denying people agency to be and speak for themselves. So that's it. And finally, I think that one of the when I was in college, I remember we kept joking, as people from small countries. I used to hang out with the kids from Sri Lanka, small country,
mm-hmm.
and the people from India, the people from Nigeria, the people from America who are around the world seemed to live in a world that was consumed by themselves and consumed by their own issues, and everybody else was just a distant agent of that. Now, I don't know what that means to the idea of geopolitics and all of that. That we can talk about another day. But in a practical sense, what it means is that people from small countries like us have to be very attuned to everybody. There's always some big guy across who could just kind of step on you and crush you. And so you hear their language pretty well. So Sri Lankans have a very good idea of India. And Ghanaians are very attuned to all nuances that come out of Nigeria. And Nigerians think those Ghanaians out there are like a pesky mosquito. They don't understand the sound.
I want to talk a little bit more about that and about nationality and ethnicity and the dawning of your awareness of these things as a child. Your mother was from Uganda and was among, I gather, a large number of people who had left the country to escape the brutality of the Idi Amin regime. There were many native Kenyans at the time who were openly disdainful of these Ugandan immigrants. Can you talk a little bit about the incident that you write about at your mother's salon?
Sure. Just a couple of corrections. My mother did not escape the Idi Amin regime. My mother came to Kenya as a student.
Forgive me. Thank you for the correction.
Yeah, just because Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania at the time had some kind of federation, and she came as a student to do a management and secretarial course, met my dad, fell in love, probably pissed off her parents quite a bit, and settled in. So the Idi Amin thing came much, much later, at a time when many countries were kind of beginning to crumble, and many of the early nations, remember, most of the African nations became independent of colonialism in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
By the early 70s, you had this, the Cold War split of one country against another, this crumble for power with big powers, but also the rise of military regimes, usually supported by one side of the Cold War or another. So the kind of beginning of the destruction of things as we knew them, and Idi Amin was only part of that phenomenon.
Forgive me, I'm going to jump in here. We need to take a quick break, and I want you to have adequate time to tell this story, so I'm going to stop just for a moment here. My guest this hour is Binyavanga Wainaina. He is founding editor of the African literary magazine Kwani and director of the Chinua Achebe Center for African Writers and Artists at Bard College. His new memoir is called One Day I Will Write About This Place. We'll resume our conversation in a moment, and you're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. We're speaking this hour with Binyavanga Wainaina. He is founding editor of the African literary magazine Kwani and director of the Chinua Achebe Center for African Writers and Artists at Bard College. His new memoir is called One Day I Will Write About This Place. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And before the break, Binyavanga, we were talking about your mother, who was originally from Uganda, and when you were a child, she was a small business owner.
Yes. She owned a hair salon, which mm-hmm. was the first kind of proper kind of middle-class hair salon full of hair dryers and hot combs and that sort of thing. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you would go there occasionally as a child because to hang out or because she needed a place to keep you while she was working?
I guess it was mostly Saturdays, mm-hmm. and we'd go. I mean, I'd go my sister and I a lot, but I think I was very close with my mother, and I was a very kind of soft, dreamy boy who was mm-hmm. always hanging on her mm-hmm. her skirts and that sort of thing. My big brother would probably be adventuring somewhere. My sister was sometimes there. But it was just a nice world to go and kind of hide and smell things. Hair salons are amazing places mm-hmm. for smells of hair and drama. Just overhear and watch things. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, being that salon, my dad would have been at work doing all kinds of important things. And those stories of Idi Amin at the time would kind of just be around because you'd have an emigre, community of people who'd be in and out talking about what had just happened. And even though my parents were very careful never to talk to us about what was going on in Uganda at the time, and it was a really terrible war, we were hearing it. And it wasn't just horrible, it was also entertaining. You know, Idi Amin was just, he was somewhere there near where Bruce Lee was, kind of horrible and funny at the same time.
He was almost like a boogeyman for you.
All these movies about him. And so, he was a boxer, and he was always coming up in Drum magazine with blondes and mercenaries and making all these provocative statements which seemed... and it was all hugely entertaining, and sometimes we didn't even really understand why my parents felt it so badly, but there are always these stories, people dying, family dying, distant people being killed, people disappearing and not being able to be found. And for a lot of those years, you had that side of my family locked in Uganda. They couldn't cross the border. You just had this person who was somehow out of control, who seemed like a child with matches.
And next door to the salon, there was a woman who owned a coffee house, and there was a conflict one day over trash cans that was really over more than that. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess at the time, I didn't have a clear idea. I must have been maybe 6 years old. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a clear idea that my mother was a foreigner. I mean, I did know she was strange in the sense that she was a very beautiful woman and looked exotic to us because even though she's from another country, she didn't have the accent of our schools and mm-hmm. our life. She wasn't a Kenyan in that way. But what happened is there was a kind of a battle over garbage cans. The municipal council used to put out cans, and they had some kind of dispute about whose can, that are we taking the cans from my mother's salon to her coffee shop. And this woman had a shop that used to, Kenya exports a lot of high-quality coffee. And at the time, in those days, you needed an export license, and certain people used to get a license to start coffee shops that would sell export quality coffee. Mm-hmm. And she had that one and used to attract a lot of tourists and rich people and glamorous people, at least in our eyes. And so she was a Kikuyu lady. I had never seen, she just came one day and had her security guard topple over these garbage cans that my mother had left outside for the municipal council to pick up. And so my mother came back and said, take them back and everything else. And it was just the hate in her eyes as she was screaming, "You people, why can't you go back to your country?" That sort of kind of really extreme xenophobia, which I hadn't seen before. That feeling that something's wrong with you, something's wrong with you people, and then suddenly you feeling, even me feeling suddenly that I was a foreigner in my own country. And the memory of that was very, very strong, that particular incident. It's just years later you start to find out that this was, you know, during Kenyatta's rule, there was a certain kind of Gikuyu bravado, and unfortunately Gikuyu is my tribe too, and a certain kind of, I don't know, like, who are the outsiders? Why do other people need to belong? Why do other people need to be doing well? Sort of thing going on. And my mother was a very, in the manner in which she was striking, it was just always immediately clear that she wasn't one of. And you could see it in this woman's eyes when that happened.
So when Kenyatta was president, he was a Gikuyu, and that, as you mentioned, is your father's tribe. When you grew up, did you have a sense for, you know, it sounds like for your family, there was this sense that overly strong tribal identification was something best avoided. Can you talk about that or clarify that for us?
Sure. No, I mean, I was, well, people tell me now that I was clueless, like, we did not have a home that had, you know, all kinds of guests flowing in, but we knew a lot of people, and we didn't invite people home out of tribal exclusivity. My parents spoke English to each other. They were not of the same tribe. But I knew, for example, that my father did not subscribe to the idea of some kind of narrow exclusivity. But I feel, too, now that people are made up a lot by their political. So I don't know that it's a tribal or an ethnic thing in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But people are made up by their politics very much. And the politics of Kenyatta were dominant. And my father was a Kenyatta supporter himself. But if you look back now at the rest of Kenya, you'd certainly get the sense that everybody else felt that there was a season of a kind of madness by a group of people, not Gikuyus, which is to say, there are many Gikuyus who did not support Kenyatta at all, but a small group of people who had hijacked the country for an agenda and wanted to make a certain feeling of themselves as, I guess you could call them, Protestant conservatives, I guess you could call them, We know how to do things and others don't know how to do things. I guess you could call them. I mean, it's amazing how from between 63, say, in the early 80s, you'd find people who talk about having old money and people having new money or having or how other people or other tribes were fundamentally incapable, you know, that their genetics or their history. So, for example, you'd find Gikuyus talking about the tribes as if they weren't a tribe.
Yeah, like they were somehow above that.
Not so much the idea of a tribal difference, but more the idea of a certain entitlement that comes with holding political power that starts to make people start to invent themselves and their identity as something exceptional, as something endowed from God, as deserving of owning independence, you know, those sorts of things, which I'm sure would not be unfamiliar to an American audience.
Mm-hmm. So as you got older, particularly with regard to the schools that were available to you, this identity that you hadn't given a great deal of thought to in the past suddenly was a major factor in your education and in other things in your life. Tell us about that.
Sure, because, of course, that was happening in a transition between governments. And I mean, I do tend to romanticize, but I do feel this quite strongly. I mean, the Kenya I know from independence to the mid-70s, the late-70s to date, has all kinds of problems. It did all kinds of things wrong. But it also must be remembered that this was the time that a huge percentage of the population got to schools, and those schools attracted students by merit. and that those schools did not discriminate by tribe, race, or any such thing.
And for a long time, a university. For a long time, a university education was free to students who were academically qualified.
Right up to the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And the primary school was subsidized too. And even in the really expensive private schools and so on, the state school education system was better and preferable. Mm-hmm. People sent their kids to private schools because they had flunked out.
Mm-hmm.
So you were sitting dribbly in grade school, I guess, or in our version of grade school, in primary school, passing your exams with kids from all over Kenya. You'd write your exams, your national exams, and quotas would send you to different national schools where you'd meet people from the rest of the country. So it was very much performance-based. But after Kenyatta died, a new president came in, Moi, and all of a sudden, the idea of victimization began. And by the way, I'm not trying to speak here as a victim. We'd, you know, as Kikuyus, we'd managed to corner our own territories, even when you're pretending to be innocent. In these cases, people are not innocent.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere inside Moi's agenda to push things along, for if not his own people, but out of a fear of a kind of Kikuyu domination too, that year, the year I wrote my primary school exams, we started getting removed from lists. So you'd qualified, we'd passed our exams, my sister and I, really well, and you're waiting to be called to a good school, and all of a sudden, we're not called anywhere. So suddenly, you become Kikuyus. And I don't mean that I wasn't a Kikuyu before that. That identity wasn't an important one to me. It may have been to my dad, but it wasn't to me.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, your parents are having, even my mother, who's not even Kikuyu, was having to call around friends to find out, because the people of Moi's tribe in our school have suddenly got themselves into the best schools in the country. It hadn't happened before. And it was a kind of a crumbling of legitimacy in the system. And it was universal. It happened to people like me and others in different kind of situations that particular year, as it may have happened to people who are non-Kikuyu in the Kikuyu years too.
Mm-hmm.
But the net sum of it was the starting to understand that the world, if I could just say that for me, I can't, as a writer, not as opposed to a political explainer or someone from a third world explaining my country to people, which is inexplicable,
mm-hmm.
The best way I'd put it is, and I believe this is, we were just born and we went to school. And because we went to school, there was a syllabus. And the syllabus showed us a map and said, this is Kenya, you are from Kenya. So even though I was in primary school in 1977, that was only 13 years after we were independent.
Yeah.
But after 8 years of school and 7 years of school and you go to high school, all those things you are shown are the truth. So it was difficult to imagine that Kenya was shakable, or that the world you knew was fragile, or that Kenya itself was fragile, new, delicate, uncertain, maybe even not workable. We don't know. We didn't know. Even if someone could have told you and analyzed it, you are what you go to school to be.
Hmm.
You are the languages that are taught in your school. So that was the first time that all of a sudden you're like, it's not so certain, that they just aren't these certainties, and that there's a whole complicated thing back there that you're not getting. And you knew with great certainty that you are aiming for a certain grade in your exam, and that grade would send you to this kind of school, and that information had been spread everywhere. And the manner of the idea that things coming, you know, your exam, which were marked by computer, this was 84, coming out and you getting the grade you got, that you're not sure of the legitimacy of your grade, you're not sure of the choice of the school because now suddenly you don't get a letter in the post, the feeling that the post cannot be trusted, the feeling that the numbers given in front of you, you don't know what they mean, starts to cast all kinds of doubt in you,
mm-hmm.
and starts to make you realize or make you feel that people like you are being marginalized against other people. And in truth, you know, there was truth in it. I couldn't get into the school that I deserved to get into. And that was a massive, massive knock. There are friends of mine who tell me now, yeah, that was a knock of privilege. You as a Kikuyu, you expected that you would anyway. That wasn't our expectation. We were being cut out of schools. There were provinces that were being cut out of the whole national system. I was clueless about that at the time, except feeling a really great disservice to something.
And the way they were able to identify you, because ostensibly the exams were marked by number as opposed to having a name attached, but it's very easy to tell who someone is, what tribe they're from, based on their name.
It's not very easy to tell, but it's easy enough to tell.
Uh-huh.
So my name is Binyavanga, which is from my mother's side, so nobody could tell what that was.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote my exam as Kenneth B. Wainaina or Kenneth Binyavanga Wainaina. But the system used to operate like this. You had an index number, and your school had an index number too, and all these were computerized numbers. And at age 12, you didn't answer written. You scribbled A, B, C, which was a multiple choice exam, and then you did one exam in English composition in pencil. So then it would go to a centralized place where teachers from all over the country would grade you in the composition only, and the rest would be marked by a computer.
Mm-hmm.
So you never saw your papers, but you trusted the system enough because your name was never written. You never wrote your name down. But of course, somewhere where you wrote your index number, your name was. So when a president has instruments of state at their disposal, they can actually, you know, people... Somebody at the special branch or the intelligence in Nakuru, in my province, could make a phone call to the education authorities and say, I want all the names associated with those index numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the system breaks down.
Binyavanga.
But in next terms, what happened is that year, Kikuyu kids found themselves missing from the letters that called them to good schools.
Let's take a break here. My guest is Binyavanga Wainaina. His new memoir is called One Day I Will Write About This Place. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Chinua Achebe Center for African Writers and Artists at Bard College. His name is Binyavanga Wainaina. His new memoir is called One Day I Will Write About This Place. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, unfortunately, because we're in the last third of the program, we're going to have to fast forward a little bit here. But you ended up in college in South Africa at a remarkable time in South Africa's history. Can you talk about that experience and what it felt like to be there in the early 90s?
Yeah, I'd say that, I mean, it's an interesting thing because, you know, what I wrote was a memoir. I wasn't writing this book really as somebody trying to understand the world,
right,
or
right.
Time Magazine or Newsweek or such and such. And so how I like to put it, and I think how it shines through clearly, it was simply that I feel like very much empathy as people of our age.
Mm-hmm.
I finished high school in 1989. That was the year that the USSR fell, and that was the year that, you know, the Berlin Wall and all of that. So when I landed in South Africa, I was landing to just try and do a cheap course. And at the time, free university education had fallen apart. Kenya, which was a very big supporter of the West, now that there was no longer a Cold War, had been thrown in the dark. These were things we were clueless about in some sense. We vaguely knew them because were kind of more interested. I was 17. I was more interested in sex than Michael Jackson and Luther Vandross and all those things. But I just found myself in South Africa in 1991. Mandela had just been released, and there was just a storm. And it was amazing and terrifying and wonderful and dreadful and great and, you know, all at the same time, because everything, here was a country that was right in the middle of the world's attention. Here was a country with an enormous battle that was coming to some kind of fruition that at the time seemed vague. You're putting on the TV and they were telling you, oh, will the Afrikaners accept it? Will the right-wing generals accept it? They're going to take over the country. Who is going to be swept? I was sitting in class when Chris Hani was shot. These were the days that Mandela was talking about nationalization because the communist season was only beginning to end. But this was also the time that I was in university and we were being told, this was 1991.
Mm-hmm.
The first, I went to register for a BA and I was told, don't register for a BA. You need to do finance or computer studies. The information age is above us. No, finance is the next big thing. And it's true. I mean, most of the people who graduated with my class in South Africa ended up working for Arthur Anderson.
This does seem like the worst possible...
And going into banking. So, you know, this was the season of the end of the Cold War and everything else. And we were... I guess that's how I see my memoir. It's not the memoir of a guy sitting in some distant country, but to understand that the seasons of the world changed.
Mm-hmm.
And people in China, well, maybe not in China, but in Taiwan certainly, stopped doing engineering and started doing banking. People at MIT stopped doing physics and started doing banking. And I was told, do finance. I just flunked very badly at it and utterly incapable of passing any exam in it. And they kept telling us that if you just finish, you could go and buy a car and go and live in a condo, and the condo would be like a loft, New York-style loft, because New York-style lofts actually everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the 90s. So, I mean, I think that was what was amazing about that time was in South Africa, that battle was still playing out. You had the ANC, which was primarily on the left of things. You didn't have something on the right of things, but you had a kind of really resistant political system called apartheid that was grappling to find its place in time. And ultimately, you know, the market won, you know. By the time there was an election in South Africa, the kind of market, open market fundamentalism that we know was ubiquitous. But at the same time, it was just a time to see a country that was a second world country, that had as many languages as I did, but had credit cards and stores and glamour and people buying things, because Kenya is that small. We didn't know those things. We just used to watch them on TV. So it's like it was TV coming back alive. But then it was TV coming back alive, not in a Kenyan accent, in a country which spoke Afrikaans and English, but at the same time, you get to get a credit card or work in banking.
So pursuing a finance degree seems like it might very well have been the worst possible choice for someone of your interest and your temperament. And for a time, you sort of descended into this existence where you ate and slept and read. Can you tell us about that time?
Yeah, I have a friend who tells me that when he went to America, he had the big sleep. He called it the big sleep, like he slept. He was a student and he passed for the first year and then he just slept.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those things. I mean, I think being far away from your parents, being far away from a fairly conservative system where you're not only your parents but your school, make sure you are in class, then suddenly you're like, you have your own money in your pocket, you can drink anytime you want. Could do it. So I couldn't tell you that at the time I went to college, I thought that I was incapable of doing a finance degree. I was a fairly good student,
mm-hmm.
and even without much applying myself, I felt did okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I really started flunking. I mean, I failed applied statistics seven times.
Seven
and
times?
And I couldn't understand what it was.
Mm-hmm.
As the psychologists will say, it's depression. I don't think it was. I just think what happened was what I had been doing since I was five was just reading. I was living in this world of books, and I was managing to kind of keep my head above water with books and life and being a social human being. And now I was like, finally, I'm out of my bedroom. My mother isn't telling me what to do. Mm-hmm. And now, so I'm like, I'm just not leaving my room today. I'll not leave it tomorrow. And all of a sudden, 4 years pass. Mm-hmm. The long and the short of it was like just 6 or 7 years just simply disappeared, where what I did was just read and read and read. And I'm in a university. My fees are being paid by somebody. So I can get more books. I can get more books in different ways. And it was horrible at the time because you're brought up to expect certain things. I've never not been on top or, you know, one of the better students among. But though all those things were stressing me out, but at the same time, I was just enjoying really kind of digesting the world and enjoying it. So I fell. Mm-hmm. And I think in more ways than anything else, this is a memoir about reading and about loving books and about loving the illness of it, the addiction to them, the feeling of words, the feeling of watching things, the feeling of feeling that the world is real inside them and faker outside them. I think that was the time that I started to consolidate myself as a person who actually just does read books for a living. Before even I was, or not for a living, as a vocation.
Mm-hmm.
Other people go to church. I read books.
Were you picky at all in what you read, or would you just read anything
No.
you got your hands on?
I was never picky. I've never been picky. I when I was a kid, I read encyclopedias, I read Famous Five, I read Hardy Boys, I read the newspaper, I read the crossword. I read anything that would not get me into trouble anytime. I read with torches, I read with lights, I read after lights out in boarding school. And now here, I had a campus library, a town library, and pocket money, and if I didn't have pocket money, I would sell stuff. I stole books from libraries. It was quite violent, self-centered. But the addiction had been there. And it's an addiction, not an illness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it as an illness. But the feeling that I can't do without this thing. Because by the time I went to college, I was reading 2-3 books a day, sometimes more, and I needed more. And it wasn't more. Starting to read better books was not because I had any fine-tuned thing. It was just a way of churning out many. I was addicted to like cheap romances for a long time. Silhouette, Mills and Boone. I did a sci-fi season. Then all of a sudden, I started reading Nadine Gordimer and stuff because mm-hmm. I was running out of things to read, and the librarians wouldn't give me any more books. And I didn't see that much of a difference at the time in the things. And I never had, even as a kid, distinguished good literature from genre and whatever. And I don't now. I'm a very happy consumer of all manner of appalling trash.
Well, Vinyamanga, I am not a writer, but it seems to me that writing is very much harder than reading and enjoying books. Can you pinpoint a moment in your life where you were born as a writer as opposed to simply a reader?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I know many writers now, and many people tell me how they were scribbling stories or they were good storytellers when they were young. I wasn't a good storyteller when I was younger, and I didn't scribble.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote very little. I started to write first because I'd run out, you know, my papers had run. I was really, really chaotic. And when I was in South Africa, when the new system was coming into the country, I'd never applied for a new student visa. So I was just paperless.
Hmm.
And being me, that was fine and not fine. But then I was like, okay, today I'll go off to the immigration office or something and figure it out, and then I'd stop at a bookstore, and then it would all end, and then a month would pass, then 6 months, then a year. I guess I didn't start liking writing. I just started to write it when I ran out of money, and then when I was old enough to not be the whiny kid calling my parents to say, I need more money. Mm-hmm. You know, my parents were not wealthy. They kind of pretty much demolished their own savings and pensions to send us abroad at a time when Kenya was falling apart. And because I hadn't been the rebellious child in the house, it was really kind of eating me up too.
Mm-hmm.
But the more it ate me up, the more I would lock myself in my room and then sleep for 5 days and so on and so forth. The point, I guess, is by the time it came, when my mother died, I'd been writing a lot for newspapers and columns and things and being paid in dodgy ways, which is one way to do it as an illegal immigrant in South Africa, which is quite extreme on people who are foreigners in their country.
Mm-hmm.
That by the time I came home without papers for my mother's funeral, there was nothing to do. So I was in my dad's house, and he was retired and a little bit upset at me, and I just steal his computer and start writing. The addiction to writing came kind of suddenly, without any plan. It came because I'd been emailing people stories a lot. It came because I kind of had been... I feel like I had been already writing things in my head.
Mm-hmm.
That the process of reading all these novels that were just a blur of novels meant that I was making things up in my head that were not really stories, because I'm not a writer who's that much story-based but word-based. And I get fascinated especially by a kind of imagery of childhood, which is still an abiding theme with me, like the sort of eye of childhood. You know, a lot of people say that you should never write about dreams and children have nothing useful to say, and I kind of think that something about the childhood intelligence that's strong. I feel like as a literary critic, which I'm not, I mean, as a person who reads a lot of books, I can claim to be a literary critic because I read them and I like them,
mm-hmm.
that I cannot clearly distinguish my intelligence for loving books as a 9-year-old and as a 40-year-old now. I can't really tell you with real honesty, rather than kind of a feeling of really pretending, that it wasn't. I can't say that when I read Black Stallion when I was 10, that up to now, how those things turned in my mind, how they shifted the world, how the words burnt me.
Hmm.
I know now when I read books, when I read fiction in particular, I want to find the same feeling of desire.
I need to jump in here. We are out of time. Binyavanga Wainaina is the author of the new memoir, One Day I Will Write About This Place. Binyavanga, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.